Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This is a special week. It's our 100th episode. To celebrate, we're counting down our top 10 most listened to podcasts from the past 3 years and sharing highlights from each, from poets to journalists to novelists and more. We hope you enjoy entering the minds of these writers. To begin, we start at number 10 with prolific science fiction author John Scalzi, who visited the AWM on October 22, 2018, to promote his book, The Consuming Fire. This episode was recorded live then. In this clip, Scalzi explains how he was able to write a book in 2 weeks and how so much of writing is simply just thinking.
So that distracts you because the world's on fire. And apparently you absolutely cannot turn away from that. And not only that, you feel compelled to write about it. So that gets you through to about June. And the book is due on June 18th at 9 a.m. And it's June 4th. And you've written maybe the prologue of the book. So there's about 80,000 words to go. So you turn to your wife and you say, this is how it's going to work. I'm going to live in my office. Every couple of hours, you're going to shove food under the door. Once a day, come and retrieve the jug. To which she responds, one, you will pee like a normal human. Yes, you will. Yes, indeed, you will. And then everything else you will do. So, and so literally from basically July or June 4th through June 18th, just wrote every day about 8,000 words a day and just cranked it out. Now, here's the thing, though. When I say, and this is where we begin the actual really interesting part of this, which is when I say that I wrote this in 2 weeks, what I actually mean to say is that I typed it in 2 weeks, because once I finished The Collapsing Empire, which was the book that was the prequel to this one, I started writing this book because I ended it on a cliffhanger. And one, I knew if I didn't resolve cliffhanger things, you would all burn me, you know, not just like an effigy, like you would have brought charcoal briquettes to the evening and it would have been very toasty for me. But I started thinking about where are these characters going? What is going to happen to them? How is this going to happen? How does this make sense? And so every day when I wasn't writing head on, I was thinking about the consuming fire. And one of the things that they like to tell you about writers is that when a writer is looking out a window, they are writing. It's not always true. Sometimes we're just looking at a squirrel, okay? But, in fact, what happens is so much of what is writing is sitting there just thinking about things. And every writer, if you ask them, will tell you the time where they spend writing that you wouldn't think that they spend their time writing. Like, I do the majority of my writing in the shower, right? The shower is a place where you're just standing there, water's hitting you. Sooner or later, you have to get clean. That's part of the deal. But most of the rest of the time, you're just sitting there, and you're not doing anything else but standing there. And because I'm not doing anything else other than standing there, my brain wanders, and it problem solves. And it thinks about the things that I have just painted myself into a corner to when I'm writing, and how to solve it, how to fix it, some of the things that I'm thinking about for this book and the book beyond it and the book beyond it. So basically, I take 40-minute showers, which is really good that I don't live in California, because otherwise I'd go to shower prison because they're very, very tight about water stuff. But I live in Ohio. We have tons of water. So I just sit there and I think. And so doing that is my way of writing. Some people write while they go on long drives. Some people write while they do the dishes. Some people clean their house obsessively, even when it doesn't need to be cleaned, because that keeps their body active while their brain is going off and doing the other thing. So much of what is writing is not sitting there typing. So much of it is thinking. Now, you have to have some bit of ordered thinking to it. You can't just let it wander. You have to actually pay attention to what your brain is saying, file it away later, so that when you come to a point where all of a sudden, holy crap, you have to write 8,000 words a day, every day, for 14 days, that you can actually come back to what you have done before, the work that you have done before. And the other way that I was able to do or write this book in 2 weeks is that I have written 13 other books or 13 other novels. And so what that meant was the muscle memory of writing novels was sufficiently advanced that things like pacing, things like ending chapters on cliffhangers, things like making sure the characters are responding believably to each other, those were all muscle memory. It's just like a guitarist who's doing the scales all the time, who plays certain songs all the time, so that when they have cause to improvise, every tool that they need has already been there, has already been developed. This was the same for me. I didn't have to worry about whether or not I could write a novel. I had done it plenty of times. I'd even written novels fairly quickly. Red Shirts was written in 5 weeks. Fuzzy Nation was written in 6 weeks. So the speed was a little weird, but it was something that I had done before. But because I had done that before, it allowed me to do that. If this had been a first novel and I had tried to write it in 2 weeks, it mostly would have been gerunds and screaming. So fortunately, that was not a problem here. But the muscle memory of writing and having not only just written novels, but having written basically every day of my life for the last 30 years made it possible to do this.
Coming in at number 9 is former U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey. We had the honor of hosting the official launch for Trethewey's memoir, Memorial Drive, on July 29, 2020. Trethewey chatted with Booklist editor Donna Seaman about the book via Zoom. In this clip, Trethewey explains the title of the book and why she felt compelled to tell her story.
Before we go too much further, I want to back up a little. The title of your book is Memorial Drive. I wonder if you could describe that landscape for us, because it's a very particular view of the self, and it's become sort of newly urgent to talk about. So I wonder if you would give us that larger context. I want to say that in all your work, you are both give, you're incredibly generous in your personal revelations. They're always in a historical context, and this goes back to your early thrill in the encyclopedias. And you're always curious about the history, about fact, about other sources. So, you know, this doesn't happen in a void. And there's a context that you're very aware of. And because you use it, it's such a perfect title in so many ways, but it's also a really significant place for us all to think about.
Right. So Memorial Drive is the road that leads from downtown Atlanta to the base of Stone Mountain. And Stone Mountain is the mountain upon which the nation's largest monument to the Confederacy is carved. You know, it's sort of a southern Mount Rushmore with Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and Jefferson Davis right up there, huge, riding on horseback, sort of looming over everything, because it's a you know, made out of stone, and so it's you know, there's a few trees on it, but it's really bald, and you know, the way that it rises there and looms over everything. It was started early in the 20th century, and strangely enough, you know, even after the civil rights movement, they didn't complete it until 1972, which is the year that my mother and I moved to Atlanta. And this thing that had been going on since, you know, birth of a nation, you know, they didn't complete until 1972, even after all the advancements in the civil rights movement, they still needed to construct this monument to send a message to Black people about their second-class citizenship, which is, of course, part of the conversation that we're having right now. But it also, for me, suggests the metaphor that I was meant to make sense of. You know, going back to, you know, my father wanting me to have a proper education and proper figurative values, as in Robert Frost's notion of a proper poetical education in the metaphor, because without it, you're not safe in science, you're not safe in history. And this was the history that I would not have been safe in had I not been able to understand the relationship of that monument to the individual death of my mother at its base. There it is telling me that this is what is important. This is what is remembered here. And this small thing is not. And so I wanted to write something that could stand up as big as that monument.
Renowned writer Walter Mosley clocks in at number 8. This episode was recorded live at the American Writers Museum on October 24th, 2018, when Mosley visited to promote his novel, John Woman. In this clip, Mosley chats with AWM board member Ivan Kane about deconstructionist history and searching for truth.
You know, America is dominated by capitalism. It's an interesting thing, you know, because people know it, but you don't feel it. Capitalism is based on production, and production is based on the production line. And the production line is like putting the left front tire on the Pinto, right? You put the left front tire on the Pinto. That's what you do. And so you don't come in one day and say, well, today I think I'm going to put in the air conditioning. They go, no. You got to get a whole new education and a whole new classification in order to be able to put in air conditioning. You put in the left front tire. Now, my left front tire is a mystery. So I write mysteries, you know. I mean, I've written 57 books, published 57 books, and only 27 of them are crime books. But people still seem to think that the only thing I can write is a mystery. And so I had to work really hard on trying to finish a book that I knew would work on a literary thing. Because what I did was, you know, I was in a PhD program in political theory, which is basically philosophy. And it turns out to be basically the philosophy of history. But nobody knew that and nobody believed it. And, you know, so even once I'd written the book, even after the 20 years were over and I wrote the book, I figured out what the ending should be. 17 publishers refused to publish my book. One guy said, too intellectual. That was it. Didn't even put a period at the end. Just said, too intellectual. One woman said, well, if you would like to come in, I could explain to you how you could make a novel work. And I was like, damn, you know. Anyway, go on. I kind of answered your question.
Well, what changed then over the 15 or 20 years you worked on it?
What do you mean, what changed?
Well, you mentioned you figured out an ending.
I figured out the ending. That's the only thing that changed. I figured out the ending. I said, oh, I see. You know, it has to end in a way that the reader has to decide what happened. Because that's the thing about deconstructionist history. My character is what I call a deconstructionist historian. Because you can never know what happened in the past. Everything you know about the past happens in the future. Think the past changes as the days go on. And so my deconstructionist historian is a guy who says, no, we don't know what happened. We can only gesture toward that. Okay. And it's a thing that makes everybody dislike him.
You mentioned you were rejected then for this novel. What had you submitted it years ago?
Or, no. Only after I finished. When I found the ending, I started sending it out. And they kept saying, no. Mm-mm. And really, honestly, they could make the money back. My publisher made the money back on this book by selling it to audiobooks. They made the exact same sum that they gave me from audiobooks. And I'm like, so anybody could have done that, you know.
Okay.
It's like, it wouldn't have cost you no money.
Yeah. Okay. Deconstructionist historian. I had some trouble with that. I had trouble making it out. At one point, the character creates history from a garbage pail.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
Well, you know, any real historian will tell you the best way to understand history is by a shopping list. Because if somebody's buying something, they really need it. They're not like going out to buy something for nothing. So I need, 3 pounds of flour, 2 bananas, whatever the thing is that they need. You can pretty much follow what they're bringing in to what they're doing. You know, like you, an architect could have a shopping list. You know, a housewife can have a shopping list. You know, guys going out hunting for the you know, the weekend are going to have a shopping list. You know, and so it's real tangible things. And so, like, if you what John decides, if I look at this trash can once a week for the next couple of months, I'm going to have a really good idea of the structure of this town and of the people of this town and what they're doing and what they're discarding and what they're keeping and what they're losing. And so that was a thing. That was a thing for him and for them. But, you know, the idea of deconstructionist history is the problem is people think they know what happened. They think they know. They don't, but they think they know. So, for instance, I'll start off by this. Just for me to say, it's one of the things I say all the time nowadays. I don't believe in the existence of white people, you know, the notion of white people. I've never even seen a white person, you know, just to begin with. Nor have I really seen a black person. Never seen a yellow person. You know, there's some people you could probably call them brown, you know, brown people. Most of us are kind of like brown people, but the idea is that if there's a group of people who call themselves white people for no other reason than they want a foot up in the world, and you know, because otherwise you'd say I'm Irish or German or something like that. You know, it's like, you know, you'd have a cultural identity, not a color identity. But the idea of that is so influenced what we call history, that you have written history that leaves out all of the Chinese, all of the natives, all of the natives in Spanish, all of the African Americans, certainly leaves all those people out. But those people are part of the history. So if you say your history is something that has nothing to do with the people who actually built your fucking country, then what happens is that you strangle your own potential to know your history. And so the truth is gone, which is what we feel in America today. Nobody even believes in truth anymore because they've been strangled.
Another former U.S. Poet Laureate comes in at number 7 on our most listened to episodes. Recorded via Zoom on December 8th, 2020, Billy Collins talked with Daniel Mulhall, the Irish ambassador to the U.S., about his recently published collection, Whale Day. In this clip, Collins shares his insights into his writing process and how he builds poems one line at a time.
A lot of people want to know, how do you write? I mean, do you sit down every morning and say, okay, I'm going to write a poem now or not? I know that, you know, prose writers do that. They have to do 1,000 words a day or whatever it might be, and they won't leave their room until they've got their quota of words churned out.
Right. Well, that's one of the many reasons I don't write prose. You know, I was not Aubrey Beardsley, but Max Beerbohm said that the most difficult thing about being a poet was figuring out what to do with the remaining 23.5 hours of the day. I mean, it doesn't take all that long to write a poem. If music is on, it's on. If it's not, it's not. I've never put music on in order to write to it. And I've turned music off because it has words. I can't listen to a song with words if I'm trying to make my own words. But if some jazz is on in the background, as it often is in the house, it's just part of the scene. It's and I have a number of poems about jazz, about music, and a poem about Keith Richards. So I've written about music. It's like the weather. It's a source of metaphoric possibility.
This question asks, in your daily poetry broadcasts, you've been reviewing your past works. Have you discovered some of your old poems that you hadn't read in a while? So have you made some discoveries of work that you'd maybe set aside and kind of not gone back to for a long time? Have you made some, you know, rediscoveries of your own work during your poetry podcast series?
Yeah, well, I hate to say this, but it's actually all pretty good.
Yeah,
well, that's my main discovery. I mean, I'm reading poems that I haven't looked at in 25 years or more in some cases. I don't look at them because I don't read from them at a public reading, and I'm not one to sit around reading my own poems at night. You know, like take me out and shoot me. But I'm reading through books one page at a time. So I'm reading an entire book, which takes a while. And we talk about the poems, but I've only found one or two, you know, poems that would be, you know, maybe slightly embarrassing only because they're just not very well written. So I'm afraid all I'm discovering is that I was okay. I didn't rush any work into print, for one thing. I was cautioned about that very early. It'll always be around to stink up your book, and you'll regret it forever. So I very early on never let a poem out of the house unless I was line by line by line sure of it. Not just that's a clever poem or that's a nicely emotional poem. I really feel I'm building a poem by lines. I think poets, we are like homo linearium. We are line making creatures, and it's one line at a time. I don't come off as a formal poet. I don't have end rhyme, except occasionally. I'm always writing with the ear, trying to, also writing with the beat. I'm trying to get the cadence of it. There's a lot of iambic rhythm in there. Why? Because I've studied The Prelude. I've studied Paradise Lost. I've read Shakespeare. I have internalized some kind of iambic rhythm. And if you read for 10,000 hours and read these important works that run by the iambic clock, you too will not have to think about, is this a trochee or something like that? You will have a sense of rhythm, just like you have on the dance floor.
Stepping up to the plate now, batting sixth in our lineup, is our episode all about baseball writing. Recorded via Zoom on June 16th, 2020, when Major League Baseball was still on COVID-related hiatus, essayist Joe Bonomo and sports writer Rick Thielander chatted with AWM Education Program Coordinator Courtney Borjas about baseball writing, why it is such a literary sport, and their favorite writing. In this clip, Bonomo explains why his favorite baseball writer, Roger Angel, remained prolific and relevant for decades.
I'll ask you, Joe. I mean, you made a great point about the style of Roger Angel. I was wondering if you could go into more detail, too, about what are some of his strengths? I mean, he is a prolific sports writer that has been working for decades in baseball, and that is a testament to his talent. So I was wondering if you could go more in detail about, you know, what exactly about Roger's Angel's writing talent has been so prolific throughout, you know, his entire career.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's face it. He's a gifted writer. he's a master stylist on the level of the sentence and the paragraph. And we're just lucky, baseball fans or writers in general, I think, that he found his subject and that his subject is baseball. We have to remember it took him a while to find his subject. He didn't start writing about baseball until 1962, when his then editor, William Shawn of The New Yorker, and the two of them sort of concocted this idea that maybe Roger would go down to spring training and watch the New York Mets in their first season in 1962 and see what he could come up with and write. And it turns out that Angel found his subject in baseball. He'd been a fan, of course, since he was a teenager. He saw Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth hit back-to-back home runs in the Yankee Stadium. That's how long Roger Angel's been a fan of baseball. No one has a through line like him when it comes to baseball. It's amazing. But I think the other thing we have to recognize besides, and well, a couple things. One, he was, before he wrote about baseball, he was a short story writer. And he published a collection of short stories in 1960. And he had been publishing them mostly in the New Yorker magazine, other places, for about 10 years or so. And then he eventually stopped writing short fiction, but he clearly brings a fiction writer's eye and ear and sensibility to writing about baseball. No one can write an at-bat or can describe an at-bat quite like Roger Angel. So I think he brought to bear a fiction writer's sort of sensibility for scene and for character, but also to recognize, I think, what might be a larger theme than what it is he's writing. I mean, he's writing about baseball, but he's also writing about something greater. He's writing about being alive and being a fan and belonging to something and feel like you're a member of a community. And there's a through line of a sort of identifying baseball players as sort of members of an extended family. So that was also kind of one of the larger themes he writes about. So there's that. But the other thing, and a big factor, I think, is the magazine where he ended up. The New Yorker, when Roger Angel started writing in the 60s and into the 70s and 80s, was as it is now, a weekly magazine, but it was 100 pages or more every week. And it's hard to imagine that thick of a magazine, you know, coming to your house every week. And William Shawn, Angel's first editor, gave him, famously, and all of his writers, essentially as much room as they wanted or as they needed to write, with very, very soft deadlines. Eventually, Roger sort of settled down to writing a spring training piece, and then a sort of a midsummer piece, and then a piece in the fall that summarized the playoffs and the postseason. But inside of these essays, he would go on for 20, 30, or 40 pages. And that, I think, is really what made Roger Angel special. Not just his native gifts as a writer and a storyteller, not just that he's a knowledgeable fan of baseball, but that he had the room to explore as long as he wanted anything and all aspects of baseball, anything that he found curious and that he found interesting and sort of worth exploring. And also when Shawn sent him down to the spring training in 1962, he said, he gave him a piece of great advice. It's been quoted variously, but essentially Shawn said to him, "Don't be sentimental and don't be cynical," which is great advice for a writer, great advice for a human being probably.
Coming in at number 5 is Gary Paulson, who discussed his middle grade memoir, Gone to the Woods, his own story of survival, with children's book author Betsy Bird. This program was recorded via Zoom on January 12, 2021. In this clip, Paulson details how his early childhood was troublesome and he was going down a dark path until a librarian saved his life by giving him a library card.
I'm going to back up a little. I know you asked about the librarian. The librarian to me...
There's one in the book, yeah.
Yeah. That's life and death. Seriously. Without what she did for me, I would be dead.
Explain what she did for you.
I was a poor reader and I flunked everything. I was flunking in school. I just didn't go. Teachers tried, but it was a nightmare. And just my home life was some god-awful thing. That this terrible drunken screaming fits, you know, and stuff. My parents were awful. And the library became a sanctuary. This is warm. It was in a small town in the north and cold in the winter. And I'd go in there to get warm and get away from the bullies. And she saw me there one day and asked me if I wanted a book. And I was a smart ass. I said, yeah, I'll take one. And I don't remember what it was. She gave me a book and I felt honor bound to read it. And I was a poor reader. I took it home and I staggered through the thing. I'd have to read page 2 over and over, and then page 3, and then page like that. And I don't remember a thing about the book, except I got all the way through it, and I took it back. And she gave me another book, and then another book, and then a book a week, and 2 books a week. And then she'd throw in a Dickens or a Melville. And I would be in prison or dead without that. It was that critical. The school didn't work. The state stepped in, as they do, because I just didn't go to school. And they said, so that I would not be a burden in society, that's a quote, I should either take a vocational course for auto repair or television repair. Well, I'd been goofing around with ham radio with a friend of mine, so I kind of knew about electronics. So I did have television repair. God, I wish I'd done car repair. I don't know anything about cars. And you can't fix TVs now anyway, so it's just a wasted career, you know. But because of that, the tests I took in the Army had me as a technical genius, and I went to every class. Here's one for you. A kid from a troubled family, 18 years old, is taught how to arm and use a nuclear weapon. I mean, I was good at it. I could do that. I could arm and use a nuclear weapon and take a city, a whole city, if I had a bad day. Jeez. I mean, imagine, that was not the Army where you can be all you can be type thing. It was a different Army. And I got $78 a month, which is big money.
Oh, what's this? I got a Ticonderoga here. I believe that librarian handed you.
It was a bright yellow pencil, and she sharpened it.
Which, this is not a sharp, but yes. And what did she tell you to do with that Ticonderoga?
I should write down my thought pictures. I told her about things in the woods. Because I was either in the woods or the library. Right. Or the streets between. I also set pins in a bowling alley, which was like a firefight. Very dangerous. And I started telling her about things in the woods that I would see, like deer and stuff like that. And she asked me once, she said, you should write those down. I said, for who? And she said, me. Nobody gave me anything. Nobody. Parents, nobody. And she gave me a library card. Spelled my name right. Little embossed thing. And it was my identity. It's what I became. It what God. You just have no idea. You really don't. It wasn't just pivotal. It was everything. I started to read then.
Our fourth most listened to episode features Viet Van Nguyen, Cao Kuya Yang, and Vu Tran, who spoke at the AWM on May 9th, 2018. All three writers contributed to the anthology The Displaced, Refugee Writers on Refugee Lives, which Nguyen edited. In this clip, Nguyen shares his personal experience of facing racism in his community and seeking out refuge and Asian American voices in literature.
And we've forgotten that in 1975, the majority of Americans actually did not want to accept Vietnamese refugees or Cambodian refugees or Laotian refugees. And I had a very personal reminder of that. 1978, my parents moved from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania to San Jose, California and opened perhaps the second Vietnamese grocery store in San Jose. And I remember at 10 or 11 years old walking down the street from my parents' store and seeing a sign in a store window that said, another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese. And I didn't quite know how to make sense out of that sign, but I knew it was obviously directed against people like my parents. And I thought, does the person who wrote this sign know that my parents work 12 to 14 hour days every day of the year in this grocery store except Christmas, Easter, and New Year's? Does this person know that my parents were shot in their store on Christmas Eve? Does this person know what my parents have been through in order to get to this country and to become the people that they are? And clearly, this person did not know that. This person could not empathize. This person did not see my parents as human beings. This person saw them as Vietnamese, as refugees, as threats. And then I went to a primarily white high school in San Jose, and there were a handful of us who were of Asian descent, and we knew we were different. And so every day we would gather in a corner of the campus, and we would call ourselves the Asian Invasion. So we, you know, the only language we had available for ourselves was the same racist language that was being used against my parents. And at that time, I didn't know what I was missing. I didn't know that what I needed were voices like Vu Tran, to Americanize it, Vu Tran, Vu Tran, Cao Kuya Yang. I needed these voices of refugee writers and Asian American writers. And of course they existed, but I didn't know where to find them. I didn't know who they were. And I guess we can look back on this past of the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and this paucity of refugee voices and Asian American voices, and we can say that it was partly due to structural racism, but honestly, it's mostly due to Asian parents. Asian parents, you got to do better. Don't crush the dreams of your children who want to be artists. Encourage them, nurture them, so that they too will one day grow up and write scathing autobiographies featuring you.
Number three on the list is a conversation between Fernando A. Flores and Sandra Cisneros. The two fantastic writers visited the American Writers Museum on May 16, 2019, to discuss Flores' novel, Tears of the Truffle Pig. In this clip, Cisneros and Flores swap stories about the first book they bought and how they became writers.
How do you know how to become a writer when you come from a neighborhood where there's no bookstores except Gigi's Exotic Books?
Definitely, you know? Yeah, I grew up without a place. There was no bookstores growing up in South Texas ever, so how I would get books. To me, when I growing up, right up until when I was like 22, I think, literature to me was something of the past. To me, there were no writers like writing now, you know, at the time. So I would go to the Mission Public Library, and they had a little tiny room, like a closet, where they sell books for a dollar that were damaged or something. So that's how I came across a lot of books. That's how
that
I came across.
That was your first purchase of a book at the dollar?
That was my first book purchase right
there.
Can
I tell you about my first purchase?
Yeah, that's
I didn't know there were the people. I thought books were so valuable that they were issued by the church and state, that you couldn't actually own one. Because I didn't know people owned books. I only saw them in Chicago Public Library. But I remember you'd go to the Sears, the big Sears on Holman. It was like the, if those of you who remember Sears, I'm giving away my age. They're with the big mail order catalog establishment on Holman. And they would have like the rejects or the damaged products in the basement. And like other people would, you know, on Friday night would go out to dinner. We would go to Sears. That was our big Friday night thing on payday. My mom would buy a box of popcorn and a little fistful of cashews, which she always hid in her underwear drawer, but we knew they were there, so we'd go in and steal some. And I was with my mother and father, and we would be digging in these bins in the bargain basement, damaged goods. And, you know, they would have these box sets of the classics. And there was one volume that was lost, and they were selling, and it was Alice in Wonderland. And it was 50 cents. It was red with a garish kind of popcorn oil yellow edging, pretending to be gold. And I begged if I could please have that book. It was 50 cents, and it was my first book that I bought, but not the first book, of course, I read. And I remember I loved it so much, but one day I was trying to open a bottle of perfume, and I tugged, and it spilled all over the pages of Alice in Wonderland, which made all the pages wavy, but it smelled nice.
It smelled pretty. That's great. That's a great story.
That's my story.
That's awesome. It's great how, you know, in these moments where you're able to find like a pearl in
these situations. And when you don't have books in your house,
yeah.
You know, like you, even now when people ask me to sign the book and like they crack it open, it's like, and I just like, I feel like they cracked open my bones. They're so precious and wonderful. Do you feel like that?
Yeah, definitely. I do. Yeah. You know, especially because, you know, they were so scarce growing up, you know. And
so how do you make your way from the dollar box at the Mission Library?
Yeah. So my parents were from Mexico. Yeah. My dad was born in South Texas and my mother was born in Mexico. They were both dropped out of high school. Neither of them were really readers. I grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, you know. My parents and my whole entire family did everything they could so that I would not be artistically inclined. So I never had really any kind of support network with my family or even with my friends, really. So to me, writing was always something that I did privately. And when I was about 22 years old, my car broke down. I lost my job in South Texas. I had nothing. And somebody gave me a typewriter. And I knew somebody who lived in Austin. And to me, I was like, I got to get out of South Texas. I called my friend up. And within 3 days, I moved with like $20 in my pocket to Austin, Texas with a bag of my clothes and the typewriter. And I got a job washing dishes. And this is summer of 2005. I got a job washing dishes, and that's what I would do. I'd wash dishes, and nobody would bother me. And I'd go home, and I'd read, and I'd write on the typewriter. And whenever they try to give me like a better position or raise, I'd say no. I like being here. Nobody bothers me. I can think about what I'm going to work on when I go home. You know.
You know, but that's writing short stories. But writing a novel is something else.
It is.
It's like I used to say, you know those paintings and those statues you see in Mexico of the souls in purgatory? They're like this, with like, you know, flames and chains. That's what writing a novel is like.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And I would tell my other friends, rattle your chains so I know you're alive. Because, you know, it's like a volunteering to go to jail. You know, well, I'll just go to jail for 10 years. See you later. You know, then when you get out, it's like, oh, my God, people are going to the movies. They're drinking wine. Oh, they are.
People have lives.
Yeah. And, you know, the real writers, especially in San Miguel, Lucina, as well, you know, there's a lot of faux writers in San Miguel, you know. But the real writers, when you say, like, hey, can we get together? Oh, I can't. I'm writing. But maybe... next week after 8 o'clock. You know, those are the real writers.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
The second most popular episode features New York Times cybersecurity reporter Nicole Perlroth and AWM president Carrie Cranston, who chatted via Zoom on February 26, 2021, about Perlroth's book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. In this clip, Perlroth explains why she views herself as a translator as much as a reporter.
So began my illustrious entrance to the New York Times. And since then, I have really seen my role as translator. You know, as you mentioned, I really they threw me into the deep end because the Chinese did attack the New York Times the second year I was there. And so I had the opportunity to embed with our network security team and the FBI and Mandiant, which is a company that has now become a household name because they're the number one sort of ghostbusters that you call every time you're hacked. And that was really my first frontline experience into what it's like to get hacked and by a nation state, and opened up my eyes to this new asymmetrical warfare where companies and journalists and dissidents and activists were all having to now think about defending themselves, not just from fraud and cyber criminals, but from nation states who wanted to read their communications or access their sources. And really, I think it ended up benefiting me that I didn't come into this with an IT background, because at the end of the day, my job is really to translate these threats for the everyday person. So I could go to my sources and say, read me back what you just told me, but explain it to me like I'm your 7-year-old daughter, because ultimately I'm going to have to turn it around and translate it for this lay audience. And so that's what I've done. But what I saw over the last 10 years was that each of these attacks got slightly deadlier than the last. And we haven't seen the sort of calamitous, world-ending cyber 9/11 hack that a lot of people warned me about when I was a green reporter 10 years ago at the Times covering this space. But when I looked around, what I saw was almost worse. And it's interesting to think about it in the pandemic, because we aren't seeing the big boom, but what we're seeing is almost more like a plague where our intellectual property has been stolen. Russia has hacked our elections, our power plants, our nuclear plants. Mm-hmm. Iran has emerged as this from this digital backwater into one of the most active adversaries we face. And cyber criminals are holding our hospitals and cities hostage with ransomware every day. And I felt like it needed a book to really put this all in a larger narrative that people could see all of these incidents that I was covering for the Times in the context of where we came from and where we were going.
You were just mentioning this notion of, you know, seeing the idea for a book. I'm curious, from a writing perspective, when did you decide that the book needed to be written, and how long did it take you to put this together? Because you interviewed close to 300 people, you said.
Yeah, so there were a couple things. I mean, one, I was so green in this space when I got to the New York Times that I don't think I ever had the confidence to say, I'm going to write a book about this thing. But I started seeing people who went to the Wall Street Journal who were covering these topics and had started very green selling books. And then I would read the book and I would see myself all over the footnotes. And so I had to sort of give myself this pep talk, like, you can do this. You know enough to write a book.
And finally, the moment you've all been waiting for, our most listened to episode. Recorded via Zoom on October 29th, 2020, writers Alice McDermott and Joseph O'Neill spoke with the Irish ambassador to the U.S., Daniel Mulhall, about writing and their shared Irish ancestry. In this clip, Mulhall asks about where ideas for novels come from, and both acclaimed authors share their answers and how they write to explore and learn.
Can I ask both of you, actually? I mean, how does that work? Because I think non-novelists would be keen to know, you know, does the idea of the novel, like, come into your head, you know, in a kind of a one massive sort of hit, or does it grow or whatever? How does the how do you start a novel? I mean, how do you, you know, when you sit down with the blank page on page one, what is the inspiration that has kind of created, what is there in your head before you sit down to fill that first blank page with your words? And I'm going to ask both of you that, so I'm going to ask you first, Alice, and then I'll ask Joseph, okay?
Okay. Practically speaking, it's different every time. And sometimes it's a character, sometimes it's an image. But I think the thing that, at least for me, is consistent is a sense of not knowing the idea. Not having, if I've got a great idea for a novel or even just a great story, it's a lot easier to just call someone up and tell them the story and enjoy it, you know, or have a drink and tell the story. What makes a novel has to have some mystery in it to me, sort of to borrow a cliched metaphor from another art. Starting a novel is just having a big block of marble. And somehow you intuit, that's probably the strongest word, you intuit that there's a shape in there. And if you can just get to that shape through chiseling with sentences, you may find something whole and authentic and beautiful. You might not, but that's the challenge. That's the, I think it's in there. So sometimes it's just a character. I think there's a story in that character or an image. I think there's a novel in that, but I won't know until I start working at the words.
Joseph, how would you answer that question, if I may put it to you as well?
Yeah, you know, I do often have an initial concept, but it's very broad. Like for my last novel, I was thinking Dubai. I was just very interested in Dubai. And what you quickly discover is that your conceptual kind of trigger doesn't actually get you very far. You're just sort of stuck again with the question of, you know, who are my characters? You know, what's the voice for this novel? Who do they meet? What happens? What's this novel actually about? And you only sort of come to terms. What I tend to do is I sort of tend to write something, and then I look at what I've written, and I think that what I've written will tell me what I'm supposed to be preoccupied with, because the act of writing, the whole point of writing, I suspect, is to inaugurate this kind of knowledge that you don't have, that isn't available at the conceptual stage. It's to sort of say, well, I know, because I mean, if I knew something about the world, and then I'm saying, I don't start from this starting point of knowledge. Oh, I know something about the world and I'm going to write a novel about it. On the contrary, I'm usually confused about something and find it kind of useful to sort of go into that sort of opacity, that darkness and that sort of ignorance, and try and make something.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, screenwriter Aaron Sorkin talks with Professor Dr. Ivy Wilson about adapting To Kill a Mockingbird for the stage. The conversation was recorded for the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.